If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
These moneyed men were viewed with some suspicion. They were thought to be rather duplicitous, a little bit shifty, always on the make.
That was Anne Murphy on Georgian Banking.
War is the great dynamo of making kings look for more money wherever they can get it.
And that was Judith Green on Henry I's finances. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, and Google Play. Currently, our Google Play and Kindle Fire editions are only available in the UK, but we hope to roll them out to other countries soon. Look out for details of all of this and much more besides on our website, historyextra.com. Following the global financial crisis of 2008, much attention has been paid to the ways in which the banking profession is managed and the impact that it has on wider society. University of Hertfordshire lecturer Anne Murphy argues such concerns are nothing new, however, as she tells our section editor Matt Elton about an 18th century inquiry into the Bank of England.
So what was the state of the Bank of England in the late 18th century?
OK, so in the late 18th century, the Bank of England's in a very good position. It is the manager of the state's debt, banker to the state, and therefore it has a privileged position in that respect. It has a monopoly over banking services, which prevents any bank setting up with more than six partners, which means that the Bank of England is the largest bank of the country, and it's going to remain the largest bank of the country. that monopoly does cause it some problems. There are lots of people that object to it, lots of people who would like to be able to introduce rivals to the bank, particularly with a view to trying to make the bank more efficient and more competitive. But in general, those calls are resisted and resisted quite well. So the bank is in a very strong position.
So how many people worked for the bank?
There were more than 300 by 1783. The bank starts off with just 17 clerks when it opens in 1694, but that increases quite quickly. By the end of the 18th century, business is really booming, particularly business done for the state. And this requires a really complex organisation. So more than 300 clerks, mostly working in very specialised areas with a high degree of organisation and cooperation between offices being necessary.
Okay. So physically, what would the bank have been like if you were to visit it in the period?
I think overwhelmingly noisy and confusing. It's a big place. It's complicated to negotiate your way around. By the end of the 18th century, people are publishing guides to the Bank of England, which tell customers where to go to do the kind of business that they want to do. There's also a suggestion that it's a bit of a hub in its area of the city. Lots of people come there to do business, and this attracts people who want to ply their business in that particular area. So there's lots of suggestions to the watchmen and to the guards at the bank that they might make sure that the street sellers don't come into the environs of the bank, to keep beggars out, to be on their guard for pickpockets who tend to ply their trade in the public areas of the bank. And there's also some hints at prostitutes plying their trade in the public areas of the bank. The bank is also a tourist attraction by this point. It's in a lot of the tourist guides that are produced at the end of the 18th century. And these guides are basically telling people who come to London that the bank is a place to see and to be seen at.
Sure. So, I mean, the fact that people were kind of visiting the bank in the period means they must have had a kind of an impression of bankers. How do you think they saw them?
There was a great wariness about financiers in general. They would have thought of them as the moneyed men. And these moneyed men were viewed with some suspicion. They were thought to be rather duplicitous, a little bit shifty, always on the make. You were warned that if you were doing business with these men, that you needed to be wary, you needed to be on your guard. This extends really to people like stockbrokers and stock jobbers, bankers and financiers more generally. But this is very much a general public perception. And the clerks, the bank's clerks themselves, wouldn't have viewed themselves in that way at all. You get the impression from the report and other documents that they were actually quite proud of their jobs. And they viewed the bank as giving them quite a good position in society. Especially as they moved up the hierarchical ladder, they came to regard themselves as gentlemen. And this, of course, is incompatible with the idea that they were rather shifty and duplicitous.
Okay. I mean, do we have a sense of why people viewed them as such?
Yes. I think much in the same way as today, there were a lot of people who didn't quite know what bankers and financiers did. There is always the sense that people who deal with money don't produce anything. And because they don't produce anything, they're viewed as ripping their customers off. You go and you borrow from a banker or a financier, they charge you interest. That seems like a transaction that is all one-sided. It's very good for the banker, it's very bad for the customer. And there's a general amount of suspicion about that as well. When it came to the stock market, the financiers were viewed as spreading rumours and creating problems in order to line their own pockets. So they manipulated the market. And they did very well out of that transaction. And people who were reliant upon either the government debt or their bank shares for a regular income, they did very badly out of those sorts of transactions. So there was a great deal of suspicion there as well.
Okay, so in the piece, you talk specifically about an inquiry that took place in 1783. How did this come about?
It was, there's unfortunately no smoking gun that tells us precisely why the bank set up this inquiry at this time. It's a bank-run inquiry rather than a government inquiry. But if we look at the context, I think we can work out why it was set up in 1783. And the context was the ending of the War of American Independence. Obviously, the loss of the American colonies created a great deal of anxiety at that point. There were lots of complaints about incompetence and corruption. There were lots of complaints about the idea that financiers had done very, very well out of a war that the country had done quite badly out of. So there's a great deal of concern about that. This had led to an investigation into the public finances. There were also investigations going on into the state and the management of the East India Company at this point. I think, I can't prove it, but my theory is that the management of the Bank of England were aware of all these situations. They saw the government closing in and they decided to set up their own inquiry in order to preempt a possible government inquiry in the future.
So what did the inquiry involve?
Well, the bank appointed a committee of three directors to conduct the inquiry. They gave those directors the same kind of privileges that the inspectors who'd conducted the inquiry into the bank, into the public finances rather, had had. And that was that they could call any staff, they could look at any document, they were allowed to go anywhere in the bank, and they were allowed to ask any questions that might occur to them. So they really had full permission to investigate anything that they wanted. And the way they worked was they toured the bank, they went into offices and they observed work for a day, and then they retired and talked amongst themselves. And then they interviewed various members of the staff. So they always started with the chief officer in any office. They talked to him about how his office worked, what they were supposed to do, whether there were any problems in the office. And then they worked their way down. And what they found as they worked their way down was that each clerk had a different story to tell. Very often, problems were highlighted. And very often, some of the junior clerks had really good ideas about how to make the bank more secure and more efficient.
Okay, so it was about improving what the bank did as a result of the inquiry.
Yes, I think it was about proving that the bank did a good job, proving that levels of corruption were very low, proving that the bank's clerks were concerned with their duty to the public. But they did inevitably unearth a number of problems. These were chiefly security problems. Security was found to be quite lax in a number of areas. There were lots of inefficiencies, but as I said, lots of good ideas for how to improve and how to make the bank more efficient. The chief problem that was found was a lack of attention from the senior men. The senior men tended to let their juniors get on with their work and didn't exercise enough oversight in the view of the inspectors.
One thing that I suppose the public might have been concerned about is the fact that the clerks had access to the bank vaults. How common do you think kind of that kind of malpractice by staff was?
It was incredibly common. These kind of security breaches were happening many, many times a day. I'm not sure that we can describe it as malpractice. It was certainly very poor practice, and it was regarded as such by the inspectors. But the excuse, or I suppose the reason for these poor practices, was that the bank was incredibly busy. There probably weren't enough staff, even at more than 300 staff, there probably weren't enough to do the job that they were supposed to be doing. Shortcuts had to be taken, corners had to be cut in order that the bank functioned at all. And these shortcuts, I think, often involved leaving vaults open, clerks who shouldn't necessarily have had access to vaults being allowed access, just because there was nobody else to do that work.
The inspectors also reported on the personal characteristics of the bank workers. What form did these descriptions take?
They were normally just one or two lines in the report. What tended to happen was that they would ask the senior men during their first interview, what are the men under you like? The vast majority said that the men who worked for them were extremely good, extremely competent. They didn't have very many complaints. So you get a sort of basic notion from these kind of reports that most men did well, did their business, did their jobs very well, and were very competent. The interesting point is that one of the inspectors kept a notebook as he was going round, and he made his own little notes about the men that he interviewed. And these were usually just one or two lines, but it's here that we see a little bit more detail about what the men were like. And it's here where people like Mr. Kingdon is condemned as being rather rude to the public. And you get a lot of these sort of little one or two line character summations, which offer a great deal of interest. The most interesting ones are some of the elderly men in the bank. Mr. Bolt, for example, is described as almost worn out. So no longer really capable of doing his job. Mr. Gardner, who'd worked at the bank for 39 years, was described as prejudiced to the old mould. And therefore, you know, he couldn't be convinced to engage with some of the new innovations that seemed to be coming through. So it's very interesting from that point of view. The most well-drawn character that we have, though, is Abraham Vickery, and he's well drawn because of the way he reacts to the committee, the fact that he goes in and he immediately says, well, I'm going to tell everything, I'm going to say warts and all what my men were doing, I'm going to be very honest about the shortcomings of the clerks who work for me.
How do you think people inside the bank viewed the inquiry?
I think they were quite nervous about it. I think you can see from some of the responses that the committee gets that a lot of people were observing their actions in previous offices and trying to change, trying to update their positions before the committee gets there. So you get a lot of comments saying, oh, we know you made this comment in the 3% consul's office. We've addressed that. You know, it doesn't happen in our office now. There are some others who look upon this as a bit of an opportunity. I think there are certainly some middling clerks who look at it as a way to push themselves forward and push themselves up. There are people who come in front of the committee and give the committee a long list of ideas about how to improve things, how to make things more efficient. And there are some junior clerks who look at it as a way of voicing their grievances. There were a number of offices where the working hours were extremely long and the work very complicated. And the clerks in those offices use the committee of inspection in order to improve their working conditions. They make a formal complaint to the committee that they're not being properly compensated, and they ask the committee to take their grievances to the board of directors.
So what changed as a result of the report?
There's an awful lot of changes that take place. they could be as simple as just making sure that vaults are locked and cabinets are locked at the end of the day. But the bank also tore down walls and reconstructed offices to make things more efficient. They employed more staff. They changed working hours to improve the service to the public. And I suppose the biggest change was that the senior staff were admonished and they were told that they had to keep a much closer control of the bank's business in future. So for the senior men, there was to be no more clocking off at 3:30. They needed to stay until the bank's business was done, and they needed to take a far more hands-on approach to the business in their offices.
So do we know whether the changes stayed in place? Were they long-lasting changes?
Some of them were, yes. And the longest-lasting change was that the committee that had been set up was convened on a regular basis in the years that followed, just as a method of reviewing practice, making sure that clerks were doing their job properly, making sure that security did not slip. The big problem was the fact that from the 1790s and through to 1815, the bank really faced its biggest challenge yet, and that was the wars with revolutionary and Napoleonic France. During that time, public debt increased by huge amounts. The bank's business increased by huge amounts as well. The number of its clerks went from 300 to 900 over that period. And once again, shortcuts had to be taken because that was the only way of getting business done. That was the only way of serving the public.
And what parallels do you think that we can draw with the 21st century banking crisis?
I think in the late 18th century as today, these issues all have arisen because of a more general economic crisis. So in the late 18th century, it was the costs of the War of American Independence, the supposed corruption of the public finances. And this brings financiers and the Bank of England more to the limelight. You know, there's things need to be done very clearly, and therefore the bank has to be seen to be putting its house in order. So I think it's more general crisis that highlights that financiers have questions to answer. I think also some of the problems that are highlighted by the banking inquiry of the late 18th century are very similar to the kinds of problems that we highlight today. There's a deep concern that financiers and bankers are just lining their own pockets, that their service to the public is poor. There's a deep concern about what they're taking out of their work. Today, the question is bonuses. In the late 18th century, it was tips and gratuities. How much of these tips and gratuities were going into the clerks' pockets? There's also, I think, parallel concerns about security, particularly security of personal details. And for the bank in the late 18th century, this was a big problem. Being able to preserve the security of customers' personal details was a constant battle for them. And I think there's also one important difference, and that is that the late 18th century bankers were very confident of their place and their value both to the City of London and to the country more generally. And they say very clearly that the bank should be held with an almost religious veneration. And I doubt that there are many 21st century bankers who would like to assert the same thing about their institutions.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster.
And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
That was Anne Murphy talking to Matt Elton. For more on this story, check out the January issue of BBC History magazine, which is still available as a back issue and on the iPad and Google Play. We'd love to know what you think about the podcast, and as such, we've put together a special survey for our podcast listeners. You can find it at historypodcast.questionpro.com. And as an added inducement, we're offering an iPad mini for one lucky respondent. Now, unfortunately, that prize is only available to UK residents. However, we would still be really keen to get your views wherever you're based. The address again for that is historypodcast.questionpro.com. Being a medieval king required a lot of money, with much of it spent on wine, women, and war. BBC History magazine's Charlotte Hodgman caught up with Judith Green, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Edinburgh, to find out what financial records, known as pipe rolls, can tell us about the reign of Henry I, who was one of England's wealthiest royals.
So, Judith, what exactly were pipe rolls?
They're financial accounts of medieval English kings, and they were called pipes because they were kept separately at the start. So when they were rolled up, you could see through the middle and they looked like sections of pipe, whereas other kinds of rolls kept by the medieval government were continuous. So they looked like loo rolls, in fact. You couldn't see through them.
Okay. And what can they tell us about the wealth of Henry I?
They give you statistics about finance, basically. Finance from England. You don't know anything about things he received that wasn't in the form of money or revenue he got from Normandy or presents he was sent. He was actually sent a porcupine, which we know about. He had a menagerie of exotic animals he kept at Woodstock. But pipe rolls don't tell you about that so much as revenues from land, from towns, from the church and so on.
Okay. And as well as the wealth of Henry I, what else can the pipe rolls tell us?
They tell you about people, people and their movements, and particularly the good and or the not so good, actually, and great of early 12th century England, because the single surviving original pipe roll of Henry I is securely dated. So you know that the people mentioned are either alive or dead, and you get names. And this is about, what, 50 years or so after Doomsday Book. So you can actually trace people from Doomsday Book and then see the next generations of their families. So you know about medieval England at a very, very early date and a level of detail about people you don't know for anywhere else in the world.
And how long were these pipe rolls used for? When was Henry the first person to use these?
We think that the actual idea of auditing sheriffs, the people who collected the revenues for the kings, the idea of audit in the form that we see it in the Pipe Roll might have been developed under Henry himself. But the whole idea of people bringing revenues to the treasury was obviously much older. And certainly before you get pipe rolls, you certainly were giving out the wooden tallies or receipts, because we have references to this from another source.
And who were the main sources of income for Henry?
Still land, in the terms of what came in through the Exchequer, because that's what the Exchequer was set up to do. So the most important was land and the king's rents from towns. Then you get his revenue from the Danegeld, which is still very important in the early 12th century. And no, they weren't taking it as to make the Danes go away anymore. But then the other big class of revenue for Henry was through making people pay for justice in the royal courts or to buy privileges that they wanted. They wanted to marry heiresses, or they wanted to succeed to certain lands, and you had to pay for that big time. So these were the real money spinners.
Okay, and you mentioned in your feature that a valuable source of income for the king were the Jews. Can you perhaps tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. We don't know that there were any Jewish communities in England before the Norman Conquest. And it's usually thought, in effect, that like rabbits, which is something else that came to England after 1066, that Jewish merchants and families settled in England under the protection of the Norman kings. And the Pipe Roll gives you the first information of names. You can see them in London as a very big, wealthy group of people living under the king's protection, already lending money to very high-ranking nobles, but also suffering because basically the king wasn't doing this in a disinterested way. What the king was doing was stopping other people harming the Jews by fining them himself. And you get some very big fines from the Jews on that Pipe Roll.
Fines for what exactly?
There's a very peculiar entry on that first Pipe Roll about the Jews having to pay for a sick man whom they killed. And that's what the Latin literally says. And we don't know what that means. But there was a much more famous and horrific case in 1144 where the Jews were blamed for killing a child. But it looks as if that first entry is pointing in that direction, that already people were, because they were an alien community, were regarding them with some suspicion.
Okay, and obviously that's something that's continued throughout Henry's reign.
Yes, it got a lot. It obviously got a lot worse during the 12th century, and then you got the horrific massacre at York at the end of the 12th century. We think that from London, Jewish communities spread to Norwich, to Lincoln, and to other important centres like that. And you can trace their activities on the Pipe Rolls. But later in the 12th century, there were separate records being kept because the king was obviously very keen to protect this particular class of people because of the revenue that came to him.
I mean, Henry is renowned for his wealth. What did he spend his money on?
Literally, he spent it on wine and women, but mainly war. Medieval kings are not interested in the economy in the sense that David Cameron would be interested in. War is the great dynamo of making kings look for more money wherever they can get it. But war in its general sense, you not only had to pay for knights, you had to build castles, you had to pay subsidies, you used spies. Henry had a network of spies. All of that cost money, and this is what the money was spent on. And of course, only a fraction of that is ever alluded to in the official accounts, as it were, the Pipe Rolls.
Okay, so not everything was recorded on the Pipe Rolls then?
Absolutely not. I mean, as I say, a lot of wealth that he had would have been in gold, in gems, in movable things that simply were not recorded. This is the, as it were, the official audit of England PLC, what's going through the books, literally.
Okay. I mean, you've mentioned a particularly interesting entry into the pipe rolls about the porcupine. Is there anything else that you found in the pipe rolls that has surprised you?
Yes, I should say the porcupine crops up in a chronicler who was absolutely amazed at this animal. He'd never seen anything like it, so he put it in his chronicle. But Woodstock, where Henry had his rural palace, is certainly mentioned in that pipe roll. And very often these pipe rolls talk about the wine that's being transported, the building work on particular castles. For example, in 1130, we hear about building on the Tower. We hear about building on London Bridge. So it helps historians to build up a picture of the movement of the court. The movement of queens is also interesting, not in 1130 particularly, but in Henry II's pipe rolls. We learn a lot about the movements of Eleanor of Aquitaine and the expenses of her household. And these aren't recorded anywhere else, so it's our only source of information for that. And that's particularly interesting because you can work out when Eleanor was pregnant and where she got pregnant and when she gave birth and so on. And in a way that because you've got precise dates and you can see the movements of people that you don't get from things like charters or chronicles.
And what sort of ruler was Henry I? Do we get an idea of this from the pipe rolls?
He's very keen on money. That is certainly coming through from all the chronicles. He loved stuff. He loved money in its widest sense. The more hostile reporters said he was avaricious, which is not a good thing in the Middle Ages. Most of his qualities, I think, are behind the pipe roll rather than in it. He was an immensely effective ruler. He was effective in the sense that he blinded his opponents, sometimes he castrated them. He was cruel, and some, again, chroniclers sort of say that after he's dead, usually. He's very astute. William the Conqueror, his father, was clearly a very different kind of person, hugely successful in war. It doesn't look as if Henry I was ever very keen on war, but he had to do it. And fortunately for him, he was successful when he was in battle. But it's not like his father or his elder brother, Robert Curthose, who went on the First Crusade and was a great, you know, sort of great hero of the First Crusade, or William Rufus, who employed more knights than any other ruler north of the Alps, it was said. He just loved going to war. Well, Henry wasn't like that at all. He was cunning, actually, is what he was.
And how long were pipe rolls actually used for?
They became less and less important. I've talked about the 12th century today, but obviously as time goes on, you get more and more different sets of records. So you don't need the pipe rolls quite so much. You still need them for things like spending on castles. They're still very useful. But by the end of the Middle Ages, you get the image of these clerks sitting there drawing up these rolls, which are not really terribly useful anymore. And they carry on doing it till the early 19th century. It's really in the late 18th century that they finally decide to stop issuing tallies and drawing up pipe rolls. But they seem to sort of have an afterlife. And by the early 19th century, they were wondering what to do with all this stuff. But by that time, as far as I can see, I remember once reading a book about the clerks, and these were sinecures. They were basically sending each other little notes to say, come round to my house on Thursday evening for a nice little supper. They weren't actually doing anything, really. But it's a very interesting example of bureaucratic inertia, the way that the old structures carry on. Because nobody really abolishes them. There was always somebody in post who would lose their job if you abolished a sinecure. So they tended not to get abolished and you set new officers up instead.
And do Henry's pipe rolls differ much to his predecessors or those after him?
Well, this is the tantalising question because we only have the one original for Henry I's reign. We've got a sort of shadowy reference to one a few years before. This is the only original one. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the images online, you can see that the person who drew that up was not experimenting. It wasn't an experimental document. He was drawing it up in a way that he had used the one for the year before as a sort of template. and written out all the headings and said, the Sheriff of Nottingham has to pay so much and so on. So he copied all that out. So it's already settled by the time that we have it. And it carries on being very similar. They obviously get a lot bigger by the 13th century. And the handwriting changes as one scribe dies, perhaps of the Black Death, and somebody else takes over. But actually, they stay remarkably similar.
And what do you think the value of the pipe rolls are to historians today? What can we learn from them?
It's this question of the precise dating and the figures. You can actually draw statistics up for medieval kings and for England in a way that you can't do for other European countries till much later. And you can use the pipe rolls to cross-check other sources of information. For example, we've got the anniversary of Magna Carta coming up in 2015, and there'll be a lot of, I'm sure BBC History will be doing a lot about this, but you can see from the pipe rolls in King John's reign exactly how the financial burden King John would sell anything, like all of these kings, and how that was falling, that burden was falling on particular magnates. They were having to pay through the nose to put forward their family's interests, to get their children married, to secure wardships, all of that sort of thing.
And do you think there are still things to find out from the rolls? Are there any sort of secrets to be had still?
Absolutely. I think the article in the magazine shows that you can look at the 12th century pipe rolls online now, because they were printed and they're now out of copyright, so they're available online. But most of the 13th century and onward have not been published. The Pipe Roll Society is doing this, but of course there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. So they're all sitting there at the National Archives in Kew for anyone to call up and sort of work on exactly what the finances of English kings were.
That was Judith Green speaking to Charlotte Hodgman. And if you'd like to view pipe rolls dating to the 12th and 13th centuries, then visit piperollsociety.co.uk. You can also read Judith's feature on the subject in our February issue, which is out now in all good newsagents and available on the Kindle, iPad, Kindle Fire and Google Play. Well, that's almost all for this week. Do let us know what you think on email, podcast@historyextra.com, or on social media, Twitter @HistoryExtra, or Facebook /HistoryExtra. Next week, we'll be talking about the Industrial Revolution and eugenics. Do join us for that. And in the meantime, don't forget to take our podcast survey, which is at historypodcast.questionpro.com. The History Extra weekly podcast was recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.